which predated Autostrada and Autobahnen, Belt Parkway and West Side Highway of Robert Moses, had been built around the edges of cities and between cities. Except for rare instances and short stretches, no superhighways had been built within cities. And even those short stretches of superhighways that had been built within cities had almost invariably followed open paths within them. Undeveloped riverbanks, for example, or sparsely populated corridors, as if their creators had shied away from pushing huge roads through the city's dense fabric. The most noticeable exception had been the Triborough Bridge approach highways Moses had built through Astoria and the East Bronx, but the total length of these highways had been no more than 8 miles. Now, Moses was proposing to build through the heart of the city more than 100 miles. No one had dared lay superhighways through a heavily populated modern city on anything like such a scale. Lump together all the superhighways in existence in all the cities on Earth in 1945, and their mileage would not add up to as many miles as Robert Moses was planning in 1945 to build in one city. The immensity of the physical difficulties in Moses' path could be grasped only on the ground. And on the ground, they made even engineers accustomed to immense difficulties quail. One of his proposed superhighways, for example, was the Cross Bronx Expressway, a 7-mile-long road that would run straight across that densely populated borough. The Cross Bronx Expressway would be a huge trench gouged across a city, and it would have to be gouged across the city without disturbing the city's lifelines, the water and gas mains, electric cables and telephone wires, sewers and steam pipes, streets and subways that supplied hundreds of thousands of residents of the Bronx with services too essential to be interrupted for the long months it would take to build each section of the expressway. General Thomas F. Farrell, builder of World War II's legendary Burma Road, did not fully comprehend what that meant until, now a Moses consultant, he was sent out to look over the proposed route. Standing on a bluff in Highbridge Park in Manhattan, looking across the Harlem River at the Bronx, Farrell saw staring back at him from the top of the bluffs across the river a wall 60 and 80 and 100 feet high, a wall of apartment houses. And crossing the river, entering the Bronx, Farrell saw that the wall was 7 miles deep. Athwart the route Moses had chosen for his road stood literally hundreds of buildings, close to half of them apartment houses. And an engineer like Farrell, accustomed to grasping at a glance the essentials of even the largest engineering problems, could see on his first tour of the route that apartment houses were the least of those problems. Stepping out of his limousine at a high spot on Jessup Avenue to look out over a half-mile valley to the east, the general saw that apartment houses crammed that valley solid, a staggering panorama of massed brick and mortar and iron and steel. Looking down at the map Moses had given him, he saw that the coordinator was preparing to gouge the huge trench of the expressway straight across the valley's heart. But what staggered Farrell most was not what was in the valley, but what was on the other side of it, glaring down at him from the high ridge on its far side, a ridge even higher than the one on which he was standing. On top of that ridge was not only a wall of apartment houses, big, luxurious buildings of a notable sturdiness, for on top of that ridge was the Grand Boulevard and Concourse, the Park Avenue of the Bronx, but running along the top of the ridge, a steady stream of automobiles, toy-sized in the distance. For the concourse, built at the turn of the century in imitation of Houseman's boulevards, with separate tree-shaded lanes for pedestrians, bicyclists, and horse-drawn carriages, was now a major automobile thoroughfare. Construction of an expressway would take years, Farrell knew. The stream atop the ridge could not possibly be dammed for that long. The Cross Bronx Expressway could not cross the Grand Concourse at grade. A glance told the general that carrying the expressway over the concourse on a gigantic viaduct was unfeasible. The ascent up from the valley floor would be almost 300 feet, far too steep for the big trucks that would be using the expressway. the expressway would have to avoid the concourse by diving beneath it, by diving down through the ridge, tunneling through with dynamite while not disturbing the apartment houses and road above. And, from a cross-section map he had been given, Farrell knew what was inside that ridge. Not merely a huge storm sewer and a maze of smaller utility mains, but another utility somewhat more formidable. What was inside that ridge was a railroad, the concourse line of the independent subway. Tens of thousands of persons rode that subway every day. It, too, would have to be kept in operation. And its triple tracks lay 60 feet below the top of the ridge. To get beneath them while going through the ridge, the expressway would have to dive deep indeed. And deep in the Bronx, Farrell knew, as all New York engineers knew, meant Fordham Gneiss, a rock that combined layers of unusual hardness, requiring intensive and prolonged blasting, with frightening instability that caused sliding and slipping of the rocks on even the simplest engineering jobs. The engineers building the expressway would have to blast it through the ridge while holding up above it, holding absolutely steady, even while igniting dynamite blasts that would shake a mountain, not only a tangle of sewers and mains, but a boulevard, a subway, and a row of apartment houses. And they would have to hold boulevard, buildings, and subway steady while trying to find a footing for the necessary massive supports in unstable rock. Because the expressway had to dive under the subway, it couldn't go over the valley on a viaduct. That would make the dive beneath the subway too steep. It couldn't cross the valley at grade. That would mean closing the north-south streets in it that cut across the expressway's path, and among those streets in the valley were no fewer than 5 major thoroughfares that couldn't be closed for long. It would have to burrow across the valley, and that meant holding up those streets while struggling through another maze of mains. And atop one of those streets, Farrell saw a distant skeleton of steel, the girders and tracks of the Jerome Avenue Elevated Rapid Transit Line, that would have to be kept running. While building the expressway under Jerome Avenue, Farrell realized, Moses would somehow have to hold up, for months if not for years, not only the broad, heavy avenue, but the spindly elevated structure above it, and hold it steady enough for the trains to run along it in safety. The ridge and valley, in fact, were only a microcosm of the physical difficulties in the way of the Cross Bronx Expressway. The path of the Great Road lay across 113 streets, avenues, and boulevards, sewers and water and utility mains numbering in the hundreds, 1 subway and 3 railroads, 5 elevated rapid transit lines, and 7 other expressways or parkways, some of which were being built by Moses simultaneously. All had to be kept in operation while the expressway ran below or above them. This would be a difficult enough engineering task if the engineers had sufficient space in which to work. But on the Cross Bronx Expressway, there was, Farrell could see, never going to be enough room. Blasting a tunnel and building a road while holding up above it a major street that itself is holding up a transit line is difficult enough. But holding it up when the girders which held up the transit line turned out to be resting on the spots, seemingly the only spots, capable of holding the weight of the tunnel, required the fastening to those girders of needle beams of immense strength, beams built with legs stretching out to either side that could be sunk into the next available firm rock to hold the weight. The rock was blasted and chiseled out from under the girders so carefully that the road's designer, Ernie Clark, would recall years later that we took the stuff out with a teaspoon. In one 466-foot section, the expressway ran under 4 major avenues and an elevated rapid transit line. Working with girders, some of which were 100 feet long and weighed 19 tons, the engineers were constantly hemmed in on either side by the foundations of apartment buildings that could not be condemned because the condemnation would add additional millions to the cost, and that were in constant danger of being damaged. Some of them were damaged by the blasting. Blasting a tunnel under a rapid transit line is difficult enough. Building a viaduct over the street and under the rapid transit line is less difficult, If there is 30 feet, the required clearance for streets and expressway between the top of the asphalt of the street and the bottom of the steel of the transit line. When there isn't, the room can be created only by lifting the rapid transit line into the air, so delicately that its operation is not disturbed, by jacking it into the air 0.3 inches at a time with immense hydraulic jacks and holding it solid until new girders of the right height can be installed with timbers so huge that one man who lived near the 3rd Avenue jacking operation said, "I never knew there were trees like that in the world before." Throughout the construction of the massive superhighway, Ernie Clark says, "We were always figuring in inches and 0.1 inches. In the face of such difficulties, moving a river 500 feet, a job required where the expressway crossed the Bronx River, was a feat so insignificant that in the speeches Clark made to the delegations of engineers who came from all over the United States and Europe to hear him describe the expressway's engineering, he hardly bothered to mention it. If building the huge new highways was tough, tying them together was tougher. For the knots, the interchanges between them, required so much space that even what looked like immense amounts turned out to be insufficient. So immense was the mass of swirling, intertwined lanes of links between great roads that had to be built between and up the sides of those rocky 170-foot high cliffs along the Harlem River that the unassuming Clark once ventured to suggest to an engineering convention, in his quiet way, that a new word would have to be invented to describe it. Interchange does not adequately describe the construction in this area. Two great north-south roads, the Major Deegan Expressway and the Harlem River Drive, were being built by Moses along the two banks of the Harlem. They would have to be linked up with the Alexander Hamilton Bridge, which Moses was building 170 feet above them to carry the expressway across the river valley, and both the bridge and the two riverbank highways would have to be linked as well to local streets on both sides of the river, as well as to the old Washington Bridge, which crossed the river a few hundred feet to the north of the Hamilton. A total of 22 separate ramps and 18 separate viaduct structures would be required to carry the 31 lanes of roadway necessary for the links, making the rise and the links shallow enough so that huge tractor trailers could negotiate them would have been simple if there had been sufficient room to work in. Just start the climb far enough away so that the rise in grade could be gradual. But there wasn't nearly enough room. 2,000 feet south of the Washington Bridge was another 19th-century structure, the Highbridge Aqueduct, and the massive steel and stone piers of both these structures plunged down to the riverbanks. So the Hamilton Bridge and its connecting links would have to be built between those piers, and 2,000 feet was a pittance in terms of the size required. On the Manhattan side of the river, moreover, was an existing roadway resembling an ancient Roman aqueduct, rising from the river to a tunnel cut beneath 178th Street as a connection under Manhattan to the George Washington Bridge. That roadway was supported on columns 100 feet high. Knock out one of those columns, and the roadway might collapse. The Cross Bronx Expressway would have to be fitted between them, and the expressway's width was only 5 feet less than the space between the columns. There was practically no room for maneuver at all in the placing of those 22 ramps with their 31 lanes. The grades could not be kept shallow. To keep them from being impossibly steep, they would have to wind around and around each other. Visualizing it in his mind's eye, Clark knew that the interchanges with which Moses would be filling the air on both sides of the deep valley would be the largest bowl of concrete spaghetti cooked up to that time by any highway builder in history. Some of the strands in the bowl would have to be almost incredibly thin and long. Because of the space limitations, normal-sized columns could not be used. The diameter of some, in fact, could be no more than 78.5 inches. And some of these slender columns, needed to support immense weights, would have to be 100 feet high. Radically new column designs would have to be evolved, Moses' engineers saw. The ingredients in the sauce, moreover, would have to be varied indeed. As it turned out, no two strands of spaghetti curved exactly alike, so that each piece of steel for the dozens of columns involved, for the girders supporting the roadbeds which sat atop the columns, for the beams which formed the floor of those roadbeds, for the brackets which held those beams and girders in place, had to be fabricated individually. The Cross Bronx was one of 13 expressways Robert Moses rammed across New York City. Its 7 miles were 7 out of 130. The physical problems presented by its construction were by no means unique. Even for the easiest of those monster roads, those traversing relatively open areas of the city, there were always private homes, small apartment houses, and whole factories which had to be picked up and moved bodily to new locations. For most of these roads, Moses had to hack paths through jungles of tenements and apartment houses, to slash aqueducts in two and push sewers aside, to lift railroads into the air or shove them underground. For one expressway, the Van Wyck, he had to hold up in the air the busiest stretch of railroad in the world, the switching yard through which 13 tracks and sidings of the Long Island Railroad pass over Atlantic Avenue in Jamaica, hold it up and hold it steady enough so that during the 7 months it took to slide the huge expressway underneath, the 1,100 train movements which took place daily in that yard could continue uninterrupted. None of Moses' previous feats of urban construction, immense though they had been, compared with the roads he was planning now, as is demonstrated by the cost. Highways had always cost millions of dollars. In the whole world, only a handful had cost as much as $10 million. These new highways would cost $10 million per mile. 1 mile, the most expensive mile of road ever built, cost $40 million. Their total cost would be computed not in tens, but in hundreds of millions of dollars. The total cost of the roads Robert Moses built within the borders of New York City after World War II was over $2 billion. The roads, of course, were not the largest elements in his transportation program. They were, in fact, in one sense, only links between the water crossings he was planning to carry their users over or under the water that divided the city into boroughs. The scale of these crossings made the mind boggle. No suspension bridge anywhere in the world would be as long or expensive as the Verrazano Narrows Bridge. It would be the longest such bridge ever built, its towers so far apart that in designing them, allowance had to be made for the curvature of the earth. Their tops are 1 5/8 inch further apart than their bases. There would be enough wire in the Verrazano's cables to circle the earth 5 times around the equator or to reach halfway to the moon. Enough concrete in its anchorages to pave a single-lane highway reaching all the way from New York to Washington. And more steel in its towers, taller than 70-story skyscrapers and girders than was used in the construction of the Empire State Building. No underwater vehicular tunnel in the Western Hemisphere, and only one underwater vehicular tunnel anywhere in the world, would be as long as the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel. The tile used to line it would have tiled 4,500 bathrooms. To ventilate it adequately against the fumes of 60,000 cars and trucks per day, air would have to be driven through huge ducts at the velocity of a Force 12 hurricane, and the fans which drove that air would consume daily as much electricity as is used daily by a small city. Among such marvels, even a huge suspension bridge, like the $92 million Throgs Neck, itself an engineering feat that would make most cities proud, would hardly be noticed by New York. Comparisons among public works of different types are difficult. In terms of size, however, Moses' road-building program was certainly comparable to any public works feat in history. In terms of physical difficulty, his program would dwarf them all. Immense as were the physical obstacles in Moses' path, however, the coordinator was equal to them. A technological system, engineering and construction techniques and equipment, capable of solving those physical problems, was already in existence. the methods and machines required to build mammoth highways even within a congested city had been perfected, even if they had never been used to the capacity Moses was planning to use them. As for the tangle of red tape in his way, every main and cable and sewer relocation, for example, required approval by several city departments, that was sliced through with his customary directness. Moses' aides were under standing orders to go straight to the department head at the first sign of resistance from any underling. Most city agencies closed up tight at 5 o'clock, or earlier. Working weekends was unheard of. But hours and weekends meant nothing to men who knew that when their boss wanted something done, he wanted it done, period. He didn't care how it was done. Commissioners were routed out of bed at midnight, and long after midnight, by their telephone calls. Watching a Broadway play, a commissioner would feel a tap on the shoulder, and in the flickering darkness of the theater, would see the tall form of Arthur Hotchkiss or Bill Chapin beckoning him peremptorily to the rear of the theater. One refused to leave his seat. He found himself signing forms on his lap in the third row of a darkened theater. And if some commissioner balked at overruling an underling who had refused, say, to okay a Chapin-proposed sewer relocation, his secretary would soon be telling him, "Commissioner Moses is on the line, himself." And if, as almost never happened, some commissioner remained recalcitrant, the next call his secretary would announce would probably be from the mayor. Frustration might be piled on frustration. Moses faced them all down. After he had whipped into line behind the vast overall express program, after years of effort that can only be guessed at, mayor, governor, legislature, board of estimate, city council, federal bureau of public roads, state DPW, and an army of city bureaucrats, after all agreements were signed and the bidding for contracts underway, inflation of unforeseen dimensions raised the bids to levels beyond the state's ability to pay its share. Painstakingly, he worked out and obtained legislative and voter approval for a $500 million bond issue, which allowed him to get many of the expressways underway and even to finish a few. But costs continued to soar. He had underestimated the city's share so drastically that it could not even assume those minor costs that, by law, neither state nor federal government could assume. For years, the expressways lay stalled, until the Federal Interstate Highway Act of 1956 allowed the feds to pick up 90 instead of 50%. Working through his banking allies, Moses persuaded Congress to include in the act, despite the fact that it would circumvent its drafters' original intent of creating a toll-free system, clauses allowing roads linked to toll bridges to be included in the system, thus making his expressways eligible. Then, through a dozen ingenious subterfuges, he persuaded the state to use some of its own highway building funds, freed by the reduction in the share of the costs it was to assume, to pick up some of the city costs. There were other minor but irritating inconveniences. Wars, for example. The Korean conflict was a source of real irritation. Steel was the precious metal to the highway builder, and the National Production Administration was obstinately insisting that available steel should go first to the war effort. Other cities accepted the situation without protest. Moses fired off telegrams to and pulled strings in Washington. Federal officials believed they would placate him by allocating his highways well over 10% of all steel available for civilian use, but they didn't know their man. Moses fired his next shot on the front page of the New York Times, charging that the officials were turning civilian defense efforts into a monstrous joke by sabotaging construction of arterials needed to prepare for bombing evacuation, troop, and supply movements. When federal officials tried to counter his charges with facts, Moses termed their statements gobbledygook. The Times editorialized that roads are essential in wartime, the federal decision mustn't be the last word, and New York's allocation was quickly increased by another 10,000 tons. Next it was copper, another attack, another victory. Then a strike kept the copper he had been allocated in the warehouses, but he intervened, and the warehouse doors opened. To obtain his precious rights of way, Moses dealt with other giant city real estate holders, insurance companies, railroads, banks, the Catholic Church, as if the city were a giant monopoly board, shuffling properties as casually as if they were playing cards, giving the Catholic Church, for example, space for an addition to a Fordham campus in the Bronx in exchange for an easement in Queens, handing Con Ed half a square block for a new gas storage tank, complete with guarantees of Board of Estimate easements for the concomitant underground pipeline, in exchange for 200 feet of right-of-way through a Con Ed open storage area. At Randall's Island luncheons, he made himself the broker between a dozen disparate interests, reaping, as always, the commission in right-of-way that he wanted. At one location near Fordham Road, for example, the path of the Major Deegan Expressway was blocked by both a housing development being built by the Equitable Life Assurance Society and a 217-foot-tall Con Ed gas storage tank. Negotiations were stalled until a luncheon. By dessert, in a complicated land exchange, Equitable had been served up even more land for its development. Con Ed had agreed to rearrange its distribution facilities to eliminate the necessity of the tank, and Moses was savoring the taste not only of the necessary right-of-way, but of sufficient additional land adjoining it to create a park and playground for the residents of the Equitable development. Robert Moses didn't merely solve these physical problems, he gloried in solving them. A reporter who was permitted to drive around with him on one highway inspection tour saw Moses mentally readjusting houses as though they were so many toy building blocks. One of the blocks was a three-story factory. Moses turned it around and reset it on the same plot at a different angle. Another was a church. He turned it sideways. Another was an apartment house six stories high, which, with highway officials who had flown in from all over the country watching in awe, most of them expecting the structure to collapse, was inched 100 yards out of the Van Wyck Expressway right-of-way with the possessions of 35 families still inside it. It cost at least as much, and possibly more, to move the building than it would have cost to demolish it, and many years later, Moses was quite frank about why he had decided to move it. "I moved it because everybody said you couldn't do it," he would tell the author. "I'll never do that again. Broke a lot of gas mains. That was an absolutely crazy stunt, you know." But at the recollection, a broad, genuine grin spread across Moses' face, a grin of achievement and pride. He was overflowing with pride at his construction feats. The reporter painted a picture of a man happy as he played with his toy blocks. When the limousine reached Van Cortlandt Park, the reporter wrote, Moses began chuckling over reminiscences of the attempt by the bird lovers to stop him from running the Major Deegan Expressway through a swamp in the park that they had wanted preserved as a bird sanctuary. They had tried to obtain an injunction, he said, but we just filled in a little faster. During construction of the Brooklyn-Queens Expressway, Moses rented the penthouse floor of the Marguerite Hotel, an old, sedate establishment right next to the expressway's route, and used it as an office. It had two advantages. Only a very few people knew of its existence, so he was interrupted by few telephone calls, and he could look down on the construction as he worked. And he spent a lot of time looking down on it, watching the cranes and derricks and earth-moving machines that looked like toys far below him, moving about in the giant trench being cut through mile after mile of densely packed houses. A big black figure against the sunset in the late afternoon, like a giant gazing down on the giant road he was molding. "And I'll tell you," says one of the men who spent a lot of time at the old hotel with him, "I never saw R.M. look happier than he did when he was looking down out of that window." It was not the physical problems that were the most difficult to solve, however, but the political. A technology for solving the physical problems had been perfected, but not the methods and machinery for the creation of large-scale urban public works in a democratic society. The American system of government almost seemed designed to make such creation as difficult as possible. It is no coincidence that, as Raymond Moley puts it, From the pyramids of Egypt, the rebuilding of Rome after Nero's fire, to the creation of the great medieval cathedrals, all great public works have been somehow associated with autocratic power. It was no accident that most of the world's great roads, ancient and modern alike, had been associated with totalitarian regimes, that it took a great Khan to build the great roads of Asia, a Darius to build the royal road across Asia Minor, a Hitler and a Mussolini to build the Autobahnen and Autostrada of Europe, that during the 400 years in which Rome was a republic, it built relatively few major roads, its broad highways beginning to march across the known earth only after the decrees calling for their construction began to be sent forth from the capital by a Caesar rather than a Senate. Whether or not it is true, as Moley claims, that pure democracy has neither the imagination, nor the energy, nor the disciplined mentality to create major improvements, it is indisputably true that it is far easier for a totalitarian regime to take the probably unpopular decision to allocate a disproportionate share of its resources to such improvements, far easier for it to mobilize the men necessary to plan and build them. The great highways of antiquity awaited the formation of regimes capable of assigning to their construction great masses of men. Rome's were built in large part by the legions who were to tramp along them. At times, the great highways of the modern age seem to be awaiting some force capable of assigning to their planning the hundreds of engineers, architects, and technicians necessary to plan them. And most important, it is far easier for a totalitarian regime to ignore the wishes of its people, for its power does not derive from the people. Under such a regime, it is not necessary for masses of people to be persuaded of an improvement's worth. The persuasion of a single mind is sufficient. This last point has a special significance for the construction of public works in a city. For in a city, such construction requires the eviction of people from their homes. Even when the public agrees in theory that a work is needed, no members of the public want to lose their homes for it. People never want their neighborhood disturbed by it. If it is to be built, they inevitably feel, let it be built somewhere else. A totalitarian regime can ignore such feelings, which is why the great city rebuildings of history, not only Haussmann's of Paris, but St. Petersburg's by Peter the Great, and Rome's, first by Nero and later by Augustus, have almost invariably been carried out by such regimes, the notable exceptions being cases such as the Great London Fire of 1666 or the saturation bombings of the German cities in 1944, in which a monumental catastrophe destroyed so much of a city that it had no choice but to rebuild, and in which the catastrophe had removed from the scene the people who might have objected. But Moses was not building under a totalitarian regime. Moses was building under a system in which permission to build could be granted only by officials who derived their power from the people. And in that light, what was most significant about the Cross Bronx Expressway was not that 7 miles of brick and mortar and steel and iron had to be removed from its path, but that 7 miles of people had to be removed, removed from homes which in a time of terrible housing crisis in New York were simply irreplaceable. People said that the route was so built up that you'd never get the politicians to say okay, Ernie Clark would later recall, and engineers who had built bigger roads even than Ernie Clark agreed. Farrell and Chapin's legendary Burma Road would symbolize to history the epitome of difficulty in construction. But Chapin understood political as well as engineering problems. Years later, he would recall the feeling that had swept over him when he had stood on Jessup Avenue staring down at the valley in the Bronx, packed edge to edge with voters' homes. I said to myself, the Burma Road was tough, but that was nothing compared to this son of a bitch. People, the people whose homes stood in the path of all Moses' urban expressways, were the most difficult problem of all. But Moses solved this problem too. Democracy had not solved the problem of building large-scale urban public works, so Moses solved it by ignoring democracy. Critics who said the coordinator simply ignored the people in his path oversimplified. He may have wanted to, but political considerations, the considerations that mattered to other public officials, made it impossible for him to do so. At least until after Bill O had been safely returned to office in 1949, Moses tried to take the people into account, tried hard. It was he who, to persuade apartment dwellers, hitherto uncompensated for eviction since they did not own the land involved, to move, persuaded the legislature to provide for their reimbursement, $100 per room and $100 for moving expenses. Finding that they still balked, for middle and lower class families in New York, no few hundreds of dollars could compensate for the loss of a comfortable apartment they could afford, he even moved a few apartment houses smaller than the one on the Van Wyck. He moved entire blocks of private homes, 263 homes on the Van Wyck Expressway alone, where there was room to move them. But along most of his routes, there was no room. And, as even his admirer Jacob Lutsky puts it, he thought about people, but if it came to a project or people, he'd take the project. He had the power to do so, to ignore or override the procedures democratic government establishes to govern the planning of public works. Was it mostly dictators who had built great urban public works of the past? In road building in and around New York, he had a dictator's powers, and he used them. He enjoyed using them, for using them gave him what was his greatest pleasure, the imposition of his will on other people. One evening, he was sitting with Sid Shapiro and several other aides in his limousine parked on a side street in Queens, studying possible locations for the Clearview Expressway. Suddenly, there appeared at the end of the street hundreds of citizens bearing torches and a scarecrow effigy labeled, in large letters, Robert Moses. The aides realized that they had happened upon an anti-expressway torchlight rally. The big black car sat at the end of the street unnoticed in the dusk by anyone in the crowd as the effigy was hoisted to a lamppost and set afire. "I didn't dare look at R.M.," Shapiro recalls. But to his surprise, his boss threw back his head and roared with laughter. And when someone suggested they drive away, R.M. said no. He wanted to stay for a while. He didn't want to miss a thing. He sat there all through the speeches comparing him to a dictator, a Hitler, a Stalin. And, says Shapiro, he laughed and laughed. R.M. really got a kick out of it. When he replied to protests about the hardships caused by his road-building programs, he generally replied that succeeding generations would be grateful. It was the end that counted, not the means. You can't make an omelet without breaking eggs. Once, in a speech, he said, "You can draw any kind of picture you like on a clean slate and indulge your every whim in the wilderness in laying out a New Delhi, Canberra, or Brasilia, but when you operate in an overbuilt metropolis, you have to hack your way with a meat axe." The metaphor, like most Moses metaphors, was vivid, but it was incomplete. It expressed his philosophy, but it was not philosophy, but feelings that dictated Moses' actions. He didn't just feel that he had to swing a meat axe. He loved to swing it. Chapter 37. 1 mile. Robert Moses built 627 miles of roads in and around New York City. This is the story of one of those miles. There is something strange about that mile. It is one of seven that make up the great highway known as the Cross Bronx Expressway. But the other six, like most of the other miles of Moses Expressways, are, roughly, straight. On a road map, a heavy red line slashing inexorably across the delicate crosshatch of streets in the borough's central expanse. There is logic, the ruthless, single-minded logic of the engineer, perhaps, but logic in that line. When it curves, the curves are shallow, the road hastening to resume its former course. But during that 1 mile, the road swerves, bulging abruptly and substantially toward the north. A closer look does not explain that bulge. It makes it not less puzzling, but more. Detailed maps show the entire area blanketed with rectangles that represent city blocks, except for one open space running east-west, parallel to the expressway, that represents an unusually wide avenue, and, directly adjacent to and below that open space, another, colored green that represents a 148-acre park. And these empty spaces lie directly in the path that the expressway would have followed had it just continued on its former straight course. All it had to do to take advantage of that corridor, to utilize for right-of-way the Avenue roadbed, together with a very narrow strip at the very top edge of the park, was to keep on the way it had been going. If the location of that 1 mile of expressway was puzzling on maps when Moses first proposed it in 1946, it was more puzzling in reality. For while the maps showed rectangles, reality was what was on those rectangles. Apartment houses lined up rank upon rank, a solid mile of apartment houses, 54 of them, 54 structures of brick and steel and mortar piled 50, 60, and 70 feet high, and each housing 30 or 40 or 50 families. Walk through the area, the proposed route of the expressway, and the blocks around it, and it was impossible not to see that keeping the road straight would hurt little. Only 6 small buildings, dilapidated brownstone tenements, would have to be torn down. Most of the right-of-way, the park and the avenue, was already in the city's possession, while turning the road to the north would destroy hundreds upon hundreds of homes, homes in which lived thousands of men, women, and children. And it would cost millions upon millions of dollars in condemnation costs for 54 apartment houses, in demolition costs for the tearing down of those buildings, in tax revenue that would otherwise be paid year after year for generations into city coffers by the building's owners. If the bulge in the expressway was puzzling to anyone studying it, it was tragic to those who didn't have to study it, to the people who lived in or near that right-of-way. For to these people, the 54 apartment buildings that would have to be destroyed were not just buildings, but homes. That mile of buildings was the very heart of the neighborhood in which they lived, a section of the Bronx known as East Tremont. The people of East Tremont did not have much. Refugees, or the children of refugees, from the little shtetls in the Pale of Settlement and from the ghettos of Eastern Europe, the Jews who at the turn of the century had fled the pogroms and the wrath of the Tsars, they had first settled in America on the Lower East Side. The Lower East Side had become a place to which they were tied by family and friends and language and religion and a sense of belonging, but from whose damp and squalid tenements they had ached to escape, if not for their own sake, then for the sake of their children, whose every cough brought dread to parents who knew all too well why the streets in which they lived were called lung blocks. Jews from the Lower East Side who made enough money to escape in style escaped to the Jewish half mile of Central Park West, the Golden Ghetto. Jews who made enough money to escape, but not that much, escaped to the Grand Concourse. The Jews of East Tremont were luckier than those who had to stay behind on the Lower East Side, but not so lucky as the Grand Concourse Jews. They were not the milliners or the cloak and suiters, but the pressers, finishers, and cutters who worked in the bare workrooms behind the ornate showrooms of the garment district. They were a long way from being rich, and their neighborhood proved it. There were no elevators in most of the 5- and 6-story buildings into which they began to flood, stopping at 182nd Street, southern border of an Italian neighborhood, as abruptly as if a fence had stood there, after the extension of the IRT elevated line just before World War I linked East Tremont to the downtown garment district. By the end of World War II, the building's galvanized iron pipes were corroding, causing leaks and drops in water pressure. A few still had bathtubs that sat up on legs. With some 60,000 persons living along its narrow streets, its population density, 441 persons per residential acre, was considered undesirable by social scientists. In moving through East Tremont, one senses a feeling of crowdedness brought on by the lack of open space and close location of buildings, one wrote. But the neighborhood provided its residents with things that were important to them. Transportation was important to the fathers who worked downtown, and the neighborhood had good transportation. With the 3rd Avenue L and the IRT White Plains Road line running right through it, it was only a few easy blocks from anywhere in East Tremont to a subway that took you right down to the garment district. Jobs were important to the fathers who didn't work downtown, and the neighborhood had jobs available, good jobs by East Tremont standards, in a miniature garment and upholstery manufacturing district that had sprung up around Park Avenue, just 10 minutes away. Shopping was important to the mothers who stayed home and took care of the kids, and the neighborhood had good shopping. East Tremont Avenue, which ran conveniently right across its center, was a bright, bustling mile of bakeries which didn't bother advertising that they baked only with butter, because all of them did. Of groceries, where your order was sliced and measured out and weighed. You didn't get everything in packages like you do now. Of kosher butcher shops. We weren't, but I bought kosher for my mother's sake, and it's the kind of meat you know in the pot. Of mama and papa candy stores, of delicatessens, filled always with the pungent aroma from the pickle barrels, whose owners got up before dawn to mix olives and pimentos and chives, or dates or caviar, into manufactured cream cheese to create individualized loaves they named Paradise or Dark Jewel. You might go to Alexander's on the concourse for clothes, but you didn't have to. Janowitz's on Tremont was just as good. You didn't even have to leave the neighborhood for a dress for a real fancy affair. They had high-priced stores on Tremont, too. Held's at the intersection of Southern Boulevard was very expensive, as good as any store on the concourse. If you didn't feel like going out, the better stores on Marmion delivered, and the stuff they delivered was just as good as if you had been there to feel it yourself. And for many items, you didn't even have to pick up the telephone. A few pushcart peddlers still roamed the streets of East Tremont, as if to remind the residents of where they had come from. Parks were important to the mothers, too. There were no playgrounds in the neighborhood. Mothers' delegations had attempted in the past to talk to the park department about the situation, but Moses' aides had never even deigned to grant them an appointment. But running down its length was Southern Boulevard, whose broad center mall had grass plots plenty big enough for little children to play on, and surrounded by benches so mothers could keep their eyes on them to make sure they didn't run out into the street. And the southwestern border of the neighborhood was Crotona Park. Beautiful, lovely, playgrounds. There was a lake, Indian Lake. Nice. We used to sit there, under the trees. We raised our children in Crotona Park. Social scientists, who had never lived on the Lower East Side, might consider East Tremont crowded. The people of East Tremont, who had, considered it open and airy, wonderfully open and airy. Thanks to Crotona Park, young adults as well as children didn't have to leave the neighborhood for recreation. It was a great park, 20 tennis courts right there, where you could walk to them, baseball diamonds, magnificent playgrounds with baskets, three-man games would be going on all weekend, you know. A big swimming pool that Moses had built during the Depression, Indian Lake, and kept really clean then, you know, and safe. Sure, people walked there at night. You never worried then. A great park. And thanks to Tremont Avenue, you didn't have to leave the neighborhood for entertainment. On the avenue's 1 mile in the neighborhood were 7 movie houses. The Bronx Zoo, with its animals roaming behind moats instead of bars, was 1 stop away on the White Plains L. The New York Botanical Garden was 3. You could walk with your children to those 2 perfect places to spend a Sunday with the kids. The neighborhood provided the things that were important to its old people. The benches over on Southern Boulevard were beautiful, gorgeous. On sunny days, you could always find the girls over there, just chatting, you know, and having a good time. On weekends, they'd be so crowded you couldn't sit down. Old men would sit there in the sun playing chess with men with whom they had been playing chess for 30 years. Kibitzers had to stand. There was a place to play chess, or cards, or just sit and talk over a cup of coffee in cold weather, too. The Y, the East Tremont Young Men's Hebrew Association, listed more than 400 senior citizens on its active membership rolls. There was no reason for an older person to be lonely in that neighborhood, says one who lived there. You knew where your kids were at night, too, says one mother. They were at the Y, which had 1,700 families as members. There were so many programs out of the Y for kids. At night, before, You never used to know where they were, what they were doing. You always used to hear about gangs. You had to worry, was he with a gang? Now you always knew where your kids were at night. Children who lived on Central Park West might be sent to expensive day camps, and when they got older, to sleepaway camps in the Adirondacks. The Y provided inexpensive day camp and sleepaway programs, the largest run by any single institution in New York City for children who lived on Cretona Park North. Schools were terribly important to the people of East Tremont. A quarter of a century after their kids had graduated, some parents could still remember the precise student-teacher ratio in their classes. And East Tremont had good schools. They were old, P.S. 44 at 176th and Prospect, the neighborhood's junior high school, had been built in 1901, and the city said there was simply no money to replace it. But there were no double sessions, and standards were high. P.S. 67, off Southern Boulevard, was the first elementary school in New York to offer lessons and supply instruments for any child who wanted to learn to play the violin. And all the schools were close, close enough for kids to walk to. To the people of East Tremont was family. In its bricks were generations. Raised in the neighborhood, Lillian Roberts married a boy from the neighborhood. They made their first apartment in a supposedly nicer section over on Fordham Road. When their first child was born, they moved back. Why? Because my husband had, oh, we both had, I guess, nostalgic feelings. The reason we moved back to that area was that we loved it so much. Lillian and her husband moved into an apartment on the third floor of a walk-up at 845 West 176th Street. On the first floor of that building, Lillian's mother, Ida Rosofsky, born in Russia, was living with Lillian's grandmother. East Tremont was friends, real friends, not just acquaintances you happened to meet because they took their children to the same playground to which you took your children, or because they belonged to the same PTA as you, but friends whom you had grown up with and were going to grow old with, boys and girls turned men and women who knew and understood you and whom you knew and understood. Says Mrs. Helen Lazarchek, everyone seemed to help one another. If there was trouble, everyone would do something for you if they could. They were always coming in and sharing what they had. If they were going away, they would give you food that you could use and they couldn't. East Tremont was a feeling of being known, in the streets and in the stores, where shopkeepers like big gruff Saul Janowitz, the mayor of East Tremont, had been selling to neighborhood families for decades. The owner of one Cretona Avenue vegetable stand had been selling vegetables in Tremont when it still largely consisted of the three large Mount farming estates, Mount Hope, Mount Eden, and Fairmount, that had given Tremont its name. He had gone from house to house with a horse and wagon then. East Tremont was a sense of community, of warmth, of the security that comes, and only comes, with a sense of belonging. Even families that could afford to have their simchas, weddings and bar mitzvahs, in the concourse plaza, generally had them instead in the neighborhood's little, somewhat shabby social halls. No one would have called East Tremont a united community. It possessed, one study observed, a myriad of social systems covering religious Landsmannschaft groups, fraternal, educational, political, and fundraising groups, engaged in a constant and shrill competition for loyalty, a competition which was not even resolved in the two areas where East Tremont might have been expected to be solid, politics and religion. FDR's hold was absolute, but only so far as FDR was concerned. In non-presidential elections, men who once, long ago, had preached from soapboxes were loyal to an older faith. Socialist, communist, American labor, and progressive parties could all count on substantial votes in East Tremont. In East Tremont, the study noted, the Yiddishist and Hebraist each had its following, with a supporting system of cultural clubs, bookstores, debating societies, etc. The neighborhood's seven synagogues were constantly competing for members and prestige. East Tremont may have been a loud community, a shrill community, a materialistic, money-conscious community, but it was a community. Robert Moses didn't think much of the apartments of East Tremont. The buildings were old, the plumbing was bad, most of them didn't even have elevators. He referred to them as tenements, as walk-ups. Or, if those nouns didn't seem to be eliciting the desired horror from his listeners, as slums. But Moses had never lived on the Lower East Side. "Tenements?" says Mrs. Silberman. "Listen, I lived in tenements. These were not tenements at all." If the apartment's plumbing was not modern, neither, happily, was the size of their rooms. Large, huge by post-war standards, and high-ceilinged. They had foyers, real foyers, L-shaped some of them, as big as rooms themselves. "I served dinner for 18 in my foyer. That's how big it was," Mrs. Silberman says. They had dining rooms, not dining areas. The apartment houses might not have had elevators, but they had, almost all of them, courtyards, and there were enough small frame houses interspersed among them to let sunlight in. "Those apartments were light and airy and cheerful," Mrs. Roberts says. Sunken living rooms were not uncommon. The sills on the windows were broad and wood. The walls were not post-war plasterboard, but thick and solid. The lines where walls met ceiling were softened with ornamental moldings. "I had what they called four rooms," says Mrs. Silberman. "Besides that big foyer, we had a kitchen with a dining area, two bedrooms, of course they each had a bathroom, what else, and a living room. I don't know how big the living room was, but it was a real nice size. When my girlfriend's daughter was engaged, I served dinner for 60 in the living room and foyer, and it wasn't even crowded. That's how big it was. We all loved our apartments." They loved them, and they could afford them. If the water pressure was low, so was the rent, scaled originally to their ability to pay by landlords who could afford to do so because they had bought land in East Tremont for as little as $2 per square foot and kept at that scale by city-instituted rent control. Mrs. Silberman was paying $100 per month for her four rooms, and that was high. Lillian Roberts was paying $62 for her four rooms. Seal Sherman had a six-room apartment, three bedrooms, a living room, kitchen with large dining area, and a foyer with a recess large enough to be a full-scale dining room. And for that apartment, Mrs. Sherman was paying $69. The rents had to be reasonable for these people to afford them. Weekly take-home pay in the garment industry, the pay on which most of these people lived, averaged well under $100. And while the generally accepted rule of thumb held that a family could afford to pay a monthly rent equal to about a week's income, this was not a rule accepted by the families of East Tremont, who had their own rule of thumb, that when you had children, you sent them to college, no matter how much scrimping and saving you had to do. The rents they were paying, low as they were in all too many cases, the absolute maximum they could afford. They lived, many of them, on the thin edge of disaster. "Clara Wertel, her husband got sick, so they had to move out," recalls Mrs. Sherman. "And Mrs. Aronofsky, her husband died. Same thing. One thing could do it, and so fast. Boom, and you were gone. Your friends never saw you again." Happy, therefore, to have those apartments, the people of East Tremont were made desperate to keep them by the harsh realities of New York's housing crisis. Finding an apartment at any price was difficult in a city whose post-war vacancy rate was an habitual 1%. Finding an apartment at a rent they could afford to pay, in a neighborhood they felt they could live in, was all but impossible. They knew how difficult it was to obtain an apartment in East Tremont. One could wait for years even after one had promised a schmear to any super who let you know about an upcoming vacancy. Similar middle-class Jewish neighborhoods with low rents in which they would be comfortable, Washington Heights, for example, were rented up just as solidly. Public housing, overwhelmingly inhabited by Negroes and Puerto Ricans, was unthinkable even for those relatively few East Tremont families whose income was low enough to qualify. No one, moreover, wanted the stigma involved in having everyone know you qualified. Huge as was the low-income housing problem, moreover, the waiting list was huger still. They had no hope of ever being able to afford the apartments in the new buildings being built in the Jewish neighborhoods around Pelham Parkway, where a two-bedroom might rent for $350 per month. As for living in one's own home on Long Island or in Westchester, that was a dream reserved for the children they were sending to college. The apartments generally available in New York for the $75 or $80 per month they could afford, or apartments in the black or Puerto Rican slums,